Hello, I'm Celeste Headley. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast is designed to bring you the best proven strategies and innovative ideas that will help you navigate your life in your career and at home. We do that through conversations with truly brilliant women and some men as well. And today we will talk with Natalie Kogan, the CEO and co-founder of Happier. Her latest book is called Happier Now. It's focused on improving people's lives through emotional health and well-being.
You know, I wonder why you think it is that there's been so much emphasis shifted to happiness research in, say, the past decade or so. And you know, it hasn't always been that way. Certainly not. It had the research into happiness itself is relatively recent. And I wonder why.
You know, I have obviously some thoughts on this. And the first one, you know, is yes, maybe research has shifted there, but I think that, you know, the search for happiness, and I'd love to define what I mean by that, because I mean something quite different, I think, from what people expect when we hear the word happiness. But it is ultimately, whatever culture we come from, whatever background, it is ultimately what we are seeking in life, right? And so I think the search within all of us has always been there. And I think maybe what's driving some of the research is because we measure things a lot now. You know, we're very, we're a world that likes to survey things and measure things. And there's been a lot of surveys that show that we're actually not making a lot of progress in terms of our emotional health and happiness. In fact, we're going down, particularly women, right? Research has shown that over the past 30, 40 years, for women, our happiness and life satisfaction has gone down. Our stress and overwhelm has gone up. And so maybe that's some of what's driving the research is to say, well, why? What's going on? I think the other factor is what's going on in the workplace, right? And it's timely. I was just preparing. I have a big keynote coming up and talking about resilience, but from a point of view of there is a burnout epidemic in the workplace. We have 85% of employees who say they're either overwhelmed or stressed out. It's costing hundreds of billions of dollars. And forget the financial cost. We spend so much of our lives working. If we're that burned out, if we're that disengaged, you know, that has a huge damper on our life. And so I think those are some of the factors that are driving the researchers to say, okay, why or what can be done, right? And my approach, obviously, and you know, I've done a lot of research in happiness and emotional health, but my primary focus around it, and this is part of my asking folks to think about it differently, is to really define happiness as a skill and not a feeling or a state of being, and to invite us to think about it as a skill, to think of our emotional health as a skill that we can cultivate through practice. And like with any skill, the more we practice, the better we become. And I think the reason I want to mention that is I think it touches on a third reason why I think there's more research. And that is, I think we need to redefine what we think of happiness, because most people, and I definitely was in this camp, and, you know, as part of my evolution, we think of happiness as almost like a prize or a bonus or, you know, something good we get once we achieve enough, do enough, you know, become something enough. And so much research has shown that that's actually quite the opposite of what the reality is. And so I think part of why there's more research going on is because we are at a point in time where I believe we need to redefine what we mean by happiness. We need to look at it as a skill so that it becomes more accessible and it stops being something we try to strive towards and begins something that is we practice in the present moment.
Okay, so I have so many questions about many of the things you just said. Let's take them one by one. Let's start first with you're describing the epidemic of burnout. This is something that a number of people have noted. However, that message has not necessarily reached the C-suite. It is much more likely to hear complaints, for example, that millennials are entitled and that they're soft. Right? Mm-hmm. And that they're complaining because they don't know how to work hard. There have been t-shirts and mugs sold that say, shut up and get back to work. How do we get a wider recognition of the fact that this is not just a millennial entitlement problem, that this is actually not only felt in other generations, but that this is a real serious health issue?
I think that even in that reaction, there's something that we can learn because, you know, so many people are so stressed out and so overwhelmed that they can't even, and I say this from personal experience, they cannot even allow themselves to pause and recognize that they're running at an unacceptable pace. And so anyone else, like a millennial who's looking for more life balance, feels threatening, feels like, oh, they're so lazy. I used to think this way, Celeste. And I really, it's really important for me to come clean about this. I used to be this person who working 20 hours a day was completely normal. Not only normal, I wore it as a badge of honor because I could do it, because I was good at it, because I was such a, oh, Natalie can get so much done. It became part of my identity. And it felt like a complete failure if I admitted that I was burning out, if I actually paused to recognize that, yeah, I was working 20 hours a week, but I was snapping at people. My work was not of highest quality. I was so stressed out and overwhelmed. I was spreading it to my teams, to my family, to everyone around me. I didn't have any of that awareness because I just didn't take a pause. I just kept working. And so, you know, I do so much. We do so much work. We have a Happier at Work program where we go into companies and we work with leaders and teams and women's leadership groups. And this is most of what I spend my time doing. And I cannot tell you how many people, you know, they're skeptical when HR brings us in or a leader, an executive who heard me speak, they bring us in because they come from this place. They're like, well, we're here to get stuff done. What's the problem? Because they can't even, and again, it's scary because when you pause and you start to ask yourself, well, what pace am I running at? Is this sustainable? Am I actually doing work that fulfills me and is meaningful to me and is of good quality, right? I think that reaction to the millennials largely comes because we are all out of breath and they're asking for something that is more sustainable. The other thing I think around millennials, and you know, I've had a lot of experience working with millennials, hiring them for different companies and different teams that I've led. And like all generations, it's not like they're all the same, right? I think I'm Gen Y or Z. I don't know. I'm 43. I always forget the label. But, you know, I have friends who are very different from me. So I think us labeling generations and like stamping them like with any modifier, lazy or hardworking, is just a defense mechanism, right? Because we fear they're asking for something that I think we actually really want. And I'll tell you just one. So my daughter is 15. She's not a millennial, but she's closer to them than I am by some metrics. And she and her friend, they're sophomores in high school. And she and her friend were over the other day. And I asked them, I said, okay, what's a cliche, a misconception about you guys, your age group, that you feel is just so off? And they in unison, Celeste, not looking at each other, in unison replied, oh, that we're lazy. And they both said, we're just exhausted. We are so tired. We have so much to get done. We feel so much pressure to do better and better. We're just exhausted. So if we're not talking a lot, it's not because we're lazy. We're just exhausted. And so I do think we have this panacea, this widespread, I don't know, exhaustion as humans. And I think what millennials are trying to do is they have seen us. They have seen us burn out. They have seen their parents burn out. They have seen their parents not be at home. I had a boss once, I'm not going to name him, when I was many careers ago, I was in finance and I was pregnant. And I came in to tell this gentleman, he was a father. He's a father of a millennial, of many millennials, several kids. And I came in to excitedly, you know, it was time to tell him I was like 5 months pregnant. And I will never forget what he said to me because he looked up at me and he said, well, congratulations. And then he paused and he said, you know, something I'm really proud of. I am really proud that I never, ever throughout my entire career missed a meeting or a board meeting because I had to go to a child's soccer game. And I thought he misspoke. I really did. I thought he, you know how you
thought he
say
went
two things? Yeah, I thought he, you know, I do that all the time. You know, you're trying to say something and you're like miss. So I like smiled, and then he repeated it, and I realized he actually meant it. And he wasn't just saying it to me because he genuinely was proud of it. He wanted to make sure I understood the deal, right? That I understood what the deal was. And so I really think that these reactions we hear of millennials are just coming from a place of, whether conscious or not conscious, deeply seated fear that we have if we just pause and look at our lives and the unsustainable pace at which we are running, most of us. They're calling that out. Whenever someone calls out something that we fear, we don't want to accept it. We usually judge and push back. And I think that, if anything, is the kind of the point person on, yes, there is an epidemic. And to the other side of your question and how we can build awareness, I actually think there is that awareness. You know, in my experience, I've never had to convince a group of people, whether it's at a keynote I'm giving or a workshop I'm doing at a company, that there is an epidemic of stress and overwhelm and burnout. People feel it. People know it. They recognize it in themselves. They recognize it in people around them. And I think what we're all thirsty for is, okay, what do we do? How do we make our lives and work more sustainable?
Although that may be self-selecting, right? I mean, the reason they may be hiring you is because they recognize that there's a problem.
Yes, I think partly that is, but I guess I'm speaking even broader. You know, I speak at a diversity of conferences, not focused on the topic of emotional health, which is what I speak about. And people like to, you know, I welcome arguments and resistance. We have interesting debates about things, but I feel like the recognition that the pace that we're all going, and not just the pace, I guess that's important for me to articulate, you know, and that's part of when I talk about burnout. I am someone who's gone through very scary burnout several years ago, and it was very scary. And the thing is, it had a little bit to do with the hours I was working, but that was a small piece of it. And so I also think that it's important, you know, the World Health Organization defined burnout as a medical condition recently. But they really spoke only about overworking. And I think that there's so many other sources of burning out. It's not just about the hours that you work. I have seen people burn out who are not, from the outside, you don't think they're working crazy hours. There's many other reasons. We bring on burnout. In my experience, I was so harsh to myself internally. I was so amazing at self-harshness and self-criticism. I never practiced self-compassion. I increased my chances of burnout. The op-ed that the Washington Post published when my book came out is titled, "I Thought Grit Would Bring Me Success," and it almost killed me. And part of the grit wasn't just the hours. It was how harsh I was with myself whenever I made a mistake, right? So how we treat ourselves, how we talk to ourselves internally, how we react to mistakes and failure also contributes to burnout. Whether we learn how to pause and appreciate small moments of joy or warmth or human connection or kindness, if we don't do that frequently, that is going to contribute to our burnout. So I think it's really important to also widen our definition. And it's not just the number of hours that we're working. Of course, that's a huge factor, but it's not all. And I do think there is this, I feel it. And again, you know, this is my field. This is what I dedicated my life to this because I struggle so much, is I do think that we as modern humans are in a place where many of us do recognize that the pace that we're at, the way that we are treating ourselves and our work and people around us is not sustainable. And we're looking for ways to shift it, to shift the way I think about it, we are looking for ways to make our daily inner experience of our lives something that isn't dreadful, isn't constantly overwhelming, and isn't constantly stressful.
So let's talk a little bit about the hedonic treadmill.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about happiness, well, I should first explain that the hedonic treadmill is a long-standing, evolutionarily based,
yes, of course,
tendency in humans that we basically return to the same level of happiness that we had before, regardless of whether it's a negative event, something horrible will happen, and you'll eventually return back to the level of happiness we were before, but also a positive event. So people may think that they're going to win the lottery and be happy for the rest of their lives, but the hedonic treadmill says most likely you'll return to the same level of happiness you had before. How does this influence the way you train people and talk to people about happiness?
Oh, 1,000%. So this hedonic treadmill, this quality that we have as people, that we are incredibly adaptable, right? Why is the hedonic treadmill? Why don't big achievements make us happy for a long time? They do, by the way, for a short amount of time, and then they don't. Why don't fancy cars or amazing vacations make us happy for a prolonged period of time? It's because our brain is incredibly adaptable. Because we are really good at getting used to things, because we need to be adaptable, because life is constant change. And if we are to survive as a species, we need to be adaptable. Also, it is an innate human quality to see growth, right? And so we are constantly seeking a change. It doesn't mean we find great ways always to grow, but we are forward looking, right? So that is inherent in who we are. And that influenced my own evolution and my learning and my research and the way that I teach emotional health and happiness 100%, because that is precisely the reason why we cannot define happiness as a state of being we'll achieve our way into or buy our way into. That is precisely why we need to look at it as a skill that we practice in an ongoing manner, that it's something that we do every day. And so this is why I, you know, and all of it again came out, I didn't approach this as a researcher. I approached this as someone who was struggling in my own life to feel even a moment of contentment. And that's where my journey began. So I was an executive. I've run several companies. I was a media and finance executive. That's where I come from. So I never approached this problem in an abstract way. It was because I was struggling so much and I really needed help and I couldn't find it. And it wasn't until I'd done all this research and began to understand how my brain works that I recognized that nothing will change unless I began to think of my emotional health and happiness like any other skill, right? My daughter plays piano. She's been playing piano for 10 years. So yes, of course she has a baseline of skill, just like you and I have a happiness baseline. All of our baselines are different, by the way. Some people, their baseline of happiness is fairly high. My husband is one of these people. He could have a really tough day, and then he just snaps back. The next morning he wakes up and everything's kind of okay. And sometimes I really want to kill him for that. I'm just kidding. But like, you know, sometimes he just like snaps back. My natural happiness set point is so low. You know, I always say I'm a tortured Russian Jewish immigrant. When I open my eyes in the morning, oh my God, I can tell you all the anxiety that I have. I can tell you all the stress. I can tell you all the possible things that could go wrong. So my baseline is lower. But if we look at happiness as a skill, all we need to do is practice. And so I use my daughter's example of playing piano. She's been playing it for 10 years. When, you know, she has a certain baseline, but guess what? When she doesn't practice, she's worse. And when she practices, she's better. And so because of the adaptability of our brain, because there's nothing, not a single achievement, purchase, experience will ever get us to some state of euphoria and we can stay there. We must shift how we think of happiness away from just a feeling that arises or a state of being we can achieve our way into, and as something that we practice and as something that we cultivate on an ongoing basis. And so my entire, not just work, my life, what I've dedicated it to is researching and practicing and teaching these skills. And I've identified these five core skills that when we practice them on an ongoing basis, there is a difference in our daily inner experience. There is a meaningful difference in our emotional health, but it begins exactly where your question ended. And that is in asking all of us to redefine happiness as not a state of being you can buy or achieve your way into, but as a skill that you practice in an ongoing, regular way.
How do you prevent people from feeling shame about sadness? When you focus on happiness, you know, I stayed at one of a friend's house and she had a sign on the wall that said positive vibes only.
Oh yeah. No, that's not me.
Yeah.
I totally hear you.
Okay, so you know what I'm asking.
I know what you're asking. Well, that's, and I love that you're asking it. And I mentioned at the very beginning that, you know, when I talk about happiness, it's in quite a different way than sometimes we expect. And that's, you know, part of the journey I went through. But there are three mindset shifts that I ask people to make when it comes to happiness and emotional health. The first we talked a little bit about, but I do want to touch on it, and I promise the second answers your question directly. But the first is that I'm asking us to recognize that happiness and emotional health are not a bonus we get at the end of living the life, quote unquote, the right way, of achieving enough, of doing enough. In fact, it's the opposite. Our emotional health and happiness are non-negotiable pieces of the foundation that we must have if we want to do all the things we want to do, right? Research shows people who are happier are less stressed, less anxious. They're more creative, more productive, more innovative. They have stronger relationships. They're more successful. They help others more often, on and on and on. So the first mindset shift that I'm asking all of us to make around happiness is to stop treating it as an outcome, an output of XYZ that we do in life, and to recognize that is a non-negotiable input into living a fulfilling life. The second mindset shift that I'm asking us to make, and these are core to the Happier Method, to my work, to my book, to my kind of unveiling and my journey. The second mindset shift is that happiness does not mean being positive all the time. It doesn't mean positive vibes only. In fact, we as human beings, we are not meant to feel good all the time. We aren't. We are meant, the reason we have all the different emotions we have is that we are meant to have them. And I recognize, I'm raising my hand, it is way easier and more fun to feel joyful and excited and content than it is sad or regretful or fearful, of course. But we are not meant to feel good all the time. And in fact, research shows that when we allow ourselves to feel the difficult feelings that we have, and I try not to use negative because we spend so much of our lives categorizing emotions, positive, negative, more positive, less negative. That's exhausting, actually. That's a waste of energy. Research shows that when you feel a difficult emotion, sadness is a great one. I spent my entire life being afraid to feel sad. I love that you asked about that, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit. But sadness is a great example. When research shows when you allow yourself to actually feel it, when you don't try to run away from it. And by the way, we all have different ways to try to run away from emotions, right? Social media, Netflix, eating too much, drinking too much, going for a run, whatever that is. We all have ways we try not to feel the things we don't want to feel. But research shows when you actually feel it, you experience it with less intensity and for a shorter amount of time, because you are not wasting all of that precious emotional energy trying not to feel it. You know, Carl Jung said, that which you resist persists. And it is absolutely true. Just because you try to avoid a quote unquote negative feeling, it doesn't go anywhere. It festers. And in the process, you are wasting so much emotional energy, and we do not have unlimited emotional energy, but you are wasting it trying to not feel something. And so the way that I define true emotional health and happiness is not about being positive all the time, but it is learning how to embrace all of the different emotions that you feel with resilience and compassion. And that is core to cultivating your happier skill. And so I love that you asked me that. And by the way, just to complete the trio, the third mindset shift is to reframe happiness as a skill and not just a feeling. But the second mindset shift is exactly that it doesn't mean you're happy-go-lucky all the time. It doesn't mean you're positive all the time. It means that you are in agreement with yourself. It means that you have the skills to get through difficult emotions with compassion and resilience. And so much of what I teach, the practices that I offer, are around that. They're actually around, how do you get through challenging times? How do you practice acceptance of your emotions? How do you practice acceptance of others' difficult emotions? That's a huge, huge challenge for all of us, because especially when someone we care about experiences a difficult emotion, all we want to do, our natural instinct, is to get them to not feel it. We want them to feel better. But the hugest lesson I've learned about that is often we skip that essential step. When we're trying to make someone feel better, we're skipping the step of actually helping them to feel okay with how they feel, which is an essential step on them feeling better. And so redefining happiness, not as feeling something positive all the time, but as learning how to embrace the very many diverse different emotions that we feel as humans, is really core to what I share and what I teach in the practices that I offer.
So I just, as an explainer, she mentioned Carl Jung, just so everyone stays with us. He was a psychiatrist, Swiss psychiatrist. He basically created analytical psychology. You've probably heard of his four major archetypes. He created the categories we know now as introvert and extrovert. Important dude. Just want to make sure everyone understands all of our references.
Yes, thank you.
So when we talk about some of the things that are holding us back from happiness, and this is something you sort of mentioned in your article about grit, but it's gotten worse even since your book came out. Some of the indicators on perfectionism are really alarming. And the worst in terms of perfectionism, we thought the millennial generation was the worst. But in fact, the indicators for Gen Z, those born between 1995 and 2015, are even higher. And the negative impacts of perfectionism are incredible, all the way up to suicide. They have an incredible impact on someone's well-being and their life. And I wonder what you think, whether this perfectionism is tied to the things that you've been discussing, a sort of misunderstanding of happiness and well-being, or what's causing the rise?
You know, it's such a great question. And in fact, you know, the panel that we just did that I led at the Pennsylvania Conference for Women, the one that was based around my work was called Happier Now. And it was all about how to find joy in everyday moments and avoid the trap of perfection. You know, we talked about this so much, and it was just to, you know, I always learn from the audience. So it was, we had 1,000 people in the room. They opened up an overflow room and filled up in 5 minutes to 1,000 people. There were so many more people waiting. I hope they got in. But the reason that I mentioned this is that just taught me, oh my God, there's so much thirst to talk about this topic and find a way out of it. Because I do think that these are related. And you know, I speak as a recovering perfectionist in process. I fully need to own that. I think that it's still something for me that I am practicing. I'm very aware that my drive to perfection drove me to that very, very scary place that I mentioned that, you know, I share when I speak. I got to a place where I really thought I was going to lose my company, my family, myself. And I believe that a big piece of that was that I had this perfect vision of happiness and myself. I really thought that once I did enough, I achieved enough meaningful things, you know, especially given that I came to this country as a refugee when I was 13 with my parents with nothing. We lived in the projects outside Detroit on welfare and on food stamps. So given where I'd started and how hard I was working, I really felt that eventually I like would achieve enough meaningful things to honor this gift that my parents gave me of growing up in America and being able to build my life here. And I felt once I did that, once I achieved all those things, once I was able to take care of my family and my parents, and then I would be in this like perfect place of happiness. I really, really thought this way. And I'm a really, you know, I'm a pretty intelligent person. And yet I had this very clear, like, I'll be happy when checklist. And when I say this on stage, Celeste, I can't tell you how many tears I see. And I always pause because I know I'm not alone. And it's all connected to what you and I have been talking about. So many of us have this view of perfect happiness that we will achieve once we've filled out this checklist that we have for ourselves. And the checklists are all different. All of our I'll be happy whens are different, right? I'll be happy when I finish my book, launch my company, finish this project, lose weight, meet my significant other, have the perfect house, whatever that is, or some combination of all of those and more, then I'll be in this place where everything will be perfect and amazing. And the thing is, that is just not possible. It isn't possible in any way because of the way that we are as human beings. We've talked about the hedonic treadmill, the fact that we adapt to everything. So that amazing house that you buy that is your dream home, it is really amazing. You're really excited. And then after a year, it's just the house that you live in. Your brain has adapted. In my book, I call this the curse of the moving baseline. So the baseline has now moved. Now this house is the new normal. So the adaptability is a huge reason why this perfection-driven happiness never works. There's many other aspects of our brain. I talk often about the negativity bias that all of our brains have. So all of our brains are more sensitive to negative stimuli, to what's wrong, to what might go wrong. And we all have it to a different degree, but we all have it. And we've developed this quality in the brain because danger usually comes with negative stimuli, right? A pack of wolves running at you, a lot of negative stimuli. And our brain has evolved to pay a lot of attention to those because our brain's job is to protect us from danger and to help us survive. I always say this, your brain's job is not to make you happy. Your brain's primary task is to help you survive. That is what it's focused on. So we all have this negativity bias. So even when we achieve the things that we want, right? That great job, the house, the relationship, looking the way we wanted, our negativity bias kicks in. And we start noticing all the things that are wrong with this thing, right? And so those are just two of the qualities of our brain. I could go on and on that literally mean that actually we can never achieve perfection. Our brain won't let us. There isn't anything that can be perfect for more than a fleeting moment. So we're all on this chase of, I'll be happy when, here's my checklist, all of these things are done. And then we get there. We've achieved all the things. We are the way we thought we would be. And perfect happiness isn't there because guess what? Perfection isn't there. We've now found new flaws in ourselves and others and what we've achieved and on and on and on.
I want to be careful here because a lot of people might think of this as a weakness or a flaw in the human brain, but it's a major strength. Our brains evolved specifically to make us more resilient this way. Go ahead, I'll let you talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing. So but to recognize that, we need to give up this vision of perfect happiness that we can achieve our way into. And it's really hard to do. And again, it's so interesting. I was just finalizing, my book is going into paperback in January. So I was just rereading the manuscript just to look for any potential errors, you know, one last time before it goes into paperback from hardcover. So I had an opportunity to reread my book for the first time. And, you know, since I wrote it, I don't think I've read the whole thing. And I was stunned by how powerfully I write just by my strength of emotion, how scary it was for me to give up the search for perfect happiness, how scary it was to recognize that it's never coming, how scary it was to embrace instead my whole humanity with my many flaws and my many awesome features and my life, and how scary it was to embrace imperfection in others, and how I had to go to a place in myself with all that fear to recognize that in a way I was using the shield almost of trying to achieve perfection as a way to not really live my life as it was. And when I let it go, and I say, you know, I didn't just one day decide not to do it. I was brought to my knees by the way I was living. I just couldn't do it anymore. And when I let go of striving for perfection, when I realized it wasn't coming in me, in my life, or in anyone else, to your point, I was able to connect to so much strength within myself. I was able to recognize how amazing, truly beautiful I was as a human, not because I was perfect, but because I was able to deal with all these imperfections in myself and the world. And so that actually led me to redefining what I meant by happiness, because it feels really great to work towards something meaningful, even if it's not working out for a long time. It feels really great to fail and get up again. It feels really great to fix something that is broken or to recognize that this is something in myself that I want to embrace. And so to your point, there is such beauty and strength in our inner resilience and in our humanity. And that's part of letting go of that perfection. But I also just, everything I just said was to the point that I want to recognize how scary it is to give up this ideal, how scary it is to recognize that that's never coming, that nothing perfect, this perfect euphoria when everything is perfect and you've achieved all your I'll be happy wins and you feel amazing. It is scary to say that is never coming. But there is so much hope when you say it. And this is, you know, it's kind of the kernel of all my work, because when you can let that go and instead say, okay, how do I cultivate my happiness in the present moment? How do I embrace that this is something I have to practice in the present moment? There is so much help coming, because there are these practices and research and these science-backed skills. There's so much. And you hear it in my voice. I can't hide it. It's a new lease on life, because you stop chasing and you start living. No, it doesn't mean you never feel sad. I felt really sad this morning. I actually don't know why. Sometimes we don't know why we feel what we feel. Sometimes these feelings just arise. But knowing that you have this toolkit, knowing that you have these skills that you can start practicing when you need them, gives so much ease, and you get to live with so much less fear, because you have this resilience, you have this toolkit that you can get through the challenging times, and you can enjoy the good ones without fear of them running out.
So I'm hoping people go out and pick up your book, obviously. I'm not going to make you repeat a lot of it, because a lot of things we've talked about you cover in your book.
Yeah.
So let's move on. And let me ask you one question about your connection with some of the headlines. And I wonder, for you as a refugee, I wonder what you think of the refugee crisis going on around us. What do you think when you see what's happening to other families who may be less lucky? And I'm not saying your family was lucky. I'm just saying that in the end, you ended up being okay. That may not be true of some of the refugees out in the world. What do you think of what's happening?
You know, the first thing I'll say is we do consider ourselves lucky as a family. You know, we've been here. So this summer, we celebrated 30 years since we came to the U.S. as refugees. Thank you. We actually went back to Russia. I went back for the first time. And it was an epic, epic journey back. I went with my husband, my daughter, and my parents. We do consider ourselves lucky. We are grateful every single day that there was this country that took us in. So we do consider ourselves lucky. Even when we were coming over, so 450,000 Russian Jews came in 1989 and 90, the way that we did through the refugee camps in Europe. But there were many thousands more that couldn't get in. And so we are very, very lucky. And it's nothing I ever forget. It's amazing. It's been 30 years. The way kind of I think about what is going on with the refugees, you know, I really try to practice. This is something that I'm really focused on in my own practice, is compassion, including compassion for people who are so anti-refugee, because I think so much of that comes from fear of the unknown, right? And one of the things that I think is so important, and it's part of the reason why I share my refugee story so often and so openly, I don't think I've ever done a talk, and I do a lot of talks, where I didn't share at least a little bit of that story. The reason I do that is, it's kind of like where you and I have started. If we just look at millennials as a blob or refugees as a blob, well, if it's unknown, we fear it. And so I share my story to say, refugees are people. There isn't like a blob of refugees. All of those are human beings. And I think a lot of the resistance and a lot of the negativity we're feeling right now is from fear, because, you know, when we are unfamiliar with something or someone, our brain goes into fear mode. It's natural. It wants to protect us. And so, again, that's kind of the lens I try to have on it. But, you know, the question is, you know, what do we do? And I think, again, the more that we cultivate, you know, I went to this meditation workshop once a couple years ago, and the teacher said something really wonderful. He said, you know, people who meditate don't start fights. They don't start wars. They don't hate others. And he said, people who meditate, they create things, they help others. He said, so I actually don't care if you're here, what the reason is you're here to learn to meditate. I'm just happy you're here. Whatever reason is, like if you want to make more money and you think meditation will help you, great. He said, because I know that when you take up this practice, you will become a more compassionate human being. You will become someone who creates goodness in the world. And the research shows, I mentioned this very lightly at the beginning, that people who are happy are more altruistic. They're more likely to help others. They're more likely to donate money. They volunteer more time. And that's, I often share this in my talks at the end. I tell people is, if you want to be a force of good in the world, if you want to be a force of good who helps others, whoever they are, your family, refugees in your community, your colleagues, you have to begin by cultivating your own emotional health, because you cannot give to others what you don't have yourself. We cannot give to others what we don't have ourselves. And so I do actually feel that encouraging people to cultivate their own emotional health and happiness, to come to a place where they're at peace with themselves, actually also helps us embrace others and embrace our differences and be more compassionate human beings towards people we know and towards people who are coming to this country who we don't know.
Natalie Kogan, thank you so much for spending time with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so grateful for this opportunity. Thank you for such thoughtful questions.
Thank you.
Natalie Kogan has come a long way from a Soviet Union refugee at the age of 13, ranging from digital media executive to CEO. She's been featured in numerous media, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and her book, The Daring Female's Guide to Ecstatic Living. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure you subscribe on Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. Share it with a friend or a colleague that might enjoy the conversations as well. And check out more offerings from one of the conferences for women that's nearest to you. There are annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. For now, I'm Celeste Headley. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.